from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, a five-part PBS series is taking a new look at a central conservation question.
Figuring out how wild animals and people can coexist is a problem that scientists like me are trying to solve the world over.
That's my guest, leading conservation scientist M. Sonjin, who traveled to dozens of countries, tracked tigers and sharks, and held baby pandas for PBS's series Earth, A New Wild. We'll talk with Sonjin about the complex links he found between humans and wildlife and how his travels are changing the way he sees his relationship to nature. Join us on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. A new PBS series is taking a fresh look at nature. It's not just showing wild animals interacting in pristine landscapes, but it's also showing humankind's relationship to our planet's wildest places. The five-part series called Earth, A New Wild, aims to show how there really is no true wilderness, that we humans are inextricably linked to every aspect of the planet's natural systems. And it's hosted by my guest, M. Sonjin, Executive Vice President of Conservation International and former lead scientist of the Nature Conservancy. Sonjin holds a doctorate from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a research faculty appointment at the University of Montana, and he's an Emmy-nominated news contributor. M. Sonjin, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much, Mina.
And you just go by Sonjin, is that
right? I do.
Why was it so important to create a series on the Earth's wildest places that showed how humans are a part of the picture?
You know, because I think that when you start realizing that you are part of nature as opposed to separate from it, then the reasons for saving nature really become about saving ourselves. It becomes in our enlightened self-interest. I think that this whole division that we've created, that nature is somehow out there and should be protected out there, and this is where we live, has had the unfortunate side effect of making us forget that people need nature. Even today on a planet with 7 billion people, with, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all the modern conveniences that we have, we still are entirely dependent on nature. Now, if I try to make a series about that, it would be kind of boring. So you had to kind of get to this in some kind of exciting way that would actually glue people to their seats for 5 hours of programming.
And actually, we have a short clip that definitely glued me to my seat and made me want to learn more about this series. It's about your visit to a place that shows the practice of humans castrating reindeer. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And you're already squirming in your seat, actually, as you're saying that. I mean, it just, look, this was one of the most shocking things I had ever seen. I'd heard about this. So the Sami people, who are the traditional reindeer herders of the Arctic, some people think the Sami are the first people who domesticated the first animal, which is reindeer. And they did this by castrating the males. Now, they'd castrate the males because they don't want them to fight and lose all their energy during the winter, and they don't want the herds to split. They want the herds to be cohesive and stay together. And yet they can't take care of these animals in the cold Arctic winters. They have to allow the animals to be wild. So they have to partially castrate them. And the best way to do this is not with a mechanical implement, as you would imagine, but it's with your teeth.
All right. Well, we have a clip here that starts with the bite.
Ooh. Wow. Is that okay? That's it.
He's never going to forget this day.
No.
When the vet bit off his testicle.
You must try to bite.
No, I don't think so.
My wife used to say, learning by doing.
I assume that did not convince you.
You had to watch and see whether I... Everyone's interested to know whether I actually bit. But let me just put it this way. You know, this show isn't an experiential show. And it's not, you know, me going out there to try to be what, you know, indigenous people are doing or be them, but to really sort of learn from them and see their way of life. And I think for me, that separation was actually a little bit important. Although that scene, you couldn't have scripted it. You really couldn't have scripted it better. Not only was the bite perfect, but there's a lot of there's lots of other things. You just have to see it to believe it.
Right. You traveled to dozens of countries for this
29.
Five-part series. Wow. And so what can viewers expect to see during this series that you'd like to highlight for them?
You know, it's a conservation series, but it really isn't. We never even use the word conservation in the series. What you see instead are these astonishing stories. Some places I had been to many times before. You know, northern Kenya is a place I am intimately familiar with. The Great Bear Rainforest of British Columbia, dozens of visits. But I still found stories there that were just mind-boggling, completely shocking, and completely changed even the way I was approaching these stories. And that's what's been surprising to me about this show, that every single one of these stories was astonishing, and every single one of them like moved me in sort of quite dramatic ways. We also go to some places that, you know, as a kid you sort of dream of going, as a scientist you dream of going, and to actually be there, like the RLC in Uzbekistan. Very hard to get to. It was the fourth largest lake in the world. Any ecology textbook will have photos of the RLC because it basically vanished in our lifetimes. The fourth largest freshwater lake on the planet vanished. We get to go there and see it. We go to Zimbabwe. We go to the Arctic. We go to the most remote atoll in the Pacific Ocean.
You mentioned the RLC, and the reason that I want to stop there for a moment is because it's actually one of the moments where you're showing how destructive humans can be to the planet. And we actually have a clip of that as well that I'd like to play, where you have visited this space where the RLC used to inhabit, and it's now just essentially a wasteland.
As the lake begins to drop, all the plants on the lakeshore now start to die. Without that resistance, the wind just howls across this landscape. The wind increases evaporation, and that means the lake level drops even faster. It exposes the lake bed, and it leaves behind a crust of salt. This salt is now picked up by the wind, and that poisons the soil and the plants up to 500 kilometers away from here.
And things keep getting worse. The shrinking lake causes the climate to shift. Winters get colder, and the summers even hotter.
The RLC is now in a death spiral. Less water, more salt, more wind. From this nightmare, there really can't be any recovery.
You know, what I found so interesting about that clip was that it was so bleak and intense. I mean, I think often when I watch nature shows, it's much more optimistic than that, or folks sort of walk a fine line and try not to be so dark about. Did you feel like you were walking that fine line, and do you feel like it was important to be more?
You know, that's interesting you say that, because I actually think if this show, the criticism that I'm going to receive, or even I get these questions a lot when I screen parts of the show, is that it's too optimistic. And, you know, I always point to the RLC sequence because, you know, I don't flinch from showing you what's going on. But I don't want it to stop there. In fact, that sequence actually starts there. And then we move to the Colorado River, and then we show the possibility of the recovery of the Colorado River. When it comes to the RLC, though, I do think it is very difficult to recover, you know, that body of water in its former glory. I don't think that'll happen. So, you know, we don't want to shy away from showing you the planet as it is in terms of the challenges in the oceans or wherever it might be. But I don't want the series to just dwell on that. In fact, we want to use that as the launching point to then move you forward into the story.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's about, right. And you do show the Colorado River and sort of the hope that exists in trying to restore, you know, the Colorado River in some areas. We're talking with conservation scientist M. Sonjin, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild. The series will premiere Wednesday, February 4th on PBS. I guess though one of the points that I wanted to make is with the RLC sequence, you're ultimately pointing out how by being destructive to nature that we are, in essence, shooting our own selves in the foot. I mean, I feel...
In the head.
In the head, okay. Right. And I feel like the emphasis, or at least I walked away feeling like how fragile and vulnerable we are as humans, as opposed to how fragile and vulnerable nature is, in sort of a funny way.
Exactly. You know, that's a brilliant observation. You're absolutely right. Right. So whenever you see these shows, we end up, you know, dwelling extraordinary amount on the fragility of nature. The truth is nature's pretty resilient. Given a little chance, it will find a way to cling or move forward. It's humans that are pretty fragile and our lives that are pretty fragile. And they're still dependent on nature. So I think that's what the show does a little bit differently. It almost tells you the human story from the perspective of nature rather than the nature story from the perspective of humans. And in that way, reminds us that even today, we still need nature.
Do you ever worry that focusing on nature's resiliency could feed some notion that nature will survive? We can pretty much, we humans are just sort of a blip. We can't do that much damage to it. And so let's pull from it everything that we can while we exist. Did you hear that concern when you were thinking about that kind of messaging about the fragility of humans versus the fragility of nature?
You know, you are right. In geologic terms, you're absolutely right. In geologic terms, life on this planet will go on. And there's really only one thing that could stop that, and that's literally, you know, an asteroid that would destroy the entire planet. But life on this planet and probably on other planets does continue to persist. So in geologic terms, nature is very, very resilient. Life is very resilient. The problem has become for us today in conservation that people only deal with conservation, saving nature, after they've dealt with all the more pressing issues in their lives. Security, where you get your food, where you get your water, where your jobs come from. All of those things take precedent over nature. And that, to me, is shooting ourselves in the head. That's the point that I wanted to change, because at the end of the day, we will act, most likely act, if it's in our own enlightened self-interest. That's the point that I want to make. I do see what you're saying, but for me, if I can remind the audience why we still need nature, then I've gone, love is not enough. I love nature. I love the amazing things about nature, but I'm not even a good enough storyteller to get more people convinced of that. So I need to give them an enlightened self-interest reason in order to save it.
When you were shooting this series, what did you find? I mean, you were talking about how you tried to find the frontiers where man and animals meet and discovering how much we need each other to survive. I was curious what you found was the most unlikely creature that's crucial to our survival.
Wow, great question. Difficult for me to think of all the places we went to. But the very last scene of the very last episode ends in New York, right in New York Harbor. And that's kind of amazing, given all the places we go to, because right there in the harbor, native oysters are still clinging. And there's this amazing woman named Kate Orff, whose mission it is to replant oysters in the bay. And she's doing it, and now doing it at real scale. And you can't imagine what that waterway looks like. And there you have the financial district, you can see the Statue of Liberty, and right there in the little puddle of water in front of me, oysters are starting to come back. And seahorses are mating right there. And horseshoe crabs are crawling onto the beach. To me, that's was an amazingly uplifting story. So, you know, New York was literally built on the back of oysters. And you might see in our lifetimes that future come back again, where New York's resilience, its safety from storms, its safety from climate change, the cleanliness of its waters, once again reliant on oysters. That's a pretty cool story.
What is your – could you talk a little bit about the phenomenon of rewilding, which is something that you touch on when you show your visit, I believe, to China and you encounter panda babies?
So, you know, there are scientists who are working on this idea that we can take parts of our ecosystem and really put back the pieces that make it functional again. An extreme would be thinking about bringing back woolly mammoths to, you know, the steppes. In a smaller scale, it's you know, the release of the California condors here in California is a part of a rewilding program, right? Every condor was brought into captivity, they've been bred, and now they're being put back in the wild to be condors and do their thing again. The Chinese are doing that with pandas, and that's probably one of the hardest things you can possibly imagine. I mean, here's an iconic, cute, cuddly animal that looks almost like a toy, almost like a cartoon character. And yet, this amazing Chinese scientist... Director Zhang Himen in Wulong is taking baby pandas that were born in captivity and then training them to be wild pandas. 2-year training program. And if they graduate, he's putting them back into the wild. And we were there, front row seats, when the first female captive-born panda was released into the wild. And I'm pleased to say she's still out there and she's still doing fine.
I was going
to
ask how she's doing.
She's doing fine. And not only that, now he's released several more since then.
And they're doing well.
They're doing well, yeah.
I mean, how do you get a captive animal to rediscover its wild instincts?
Well, it's not easy. And the first time he actually tried to do this, it didn't end up in success. He released a male panda that ended up getting killed, probably by other pandas. Other wild pandas. So what he realized is that first thing he has to do is these babies should never see humans. So when we go in there to interact with them, we have to wear panda suits. Panda suits that are covered in urine and feces of pandas, as he very eloquently put it, as I'm putting on the suit. And then you know, so then the panda thinks you're another panda and sort of ignores you. But then you use the mother to teach it these basic skills, like how to climb a tree or how to lick leeches off it or how to find the best bamboo. And he runs them quite literally through like this 10-step program, you know, step by step by step, monitoring every move they make using closed-circuit television. And only the Chinese could pull this off, to be honest. I mean, it's just such a gigantic experiment. And then if he thinks that this panda has graduated, then he gets to take it out there and put it out in the forest and follow it along.
We're talking with conservation scientist M. Sanjin, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild, which premieres Wednesday, February 4th on PBS. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And you know, you mentioned the woolly mammoth earlier. Mm. What are your thoughts on de-extinction?
You know, it's and interestingly, UC Santa Cruz does quite a lot of work on this idea. It's an interesting idea. It'll be interesting to see how it progresses, but it's always going to. I think it's going to be a niche idea in conservation. It's fine for one or two things, and but. You still need the ecological functioning of things. You know, if you bring back the passenger pigeon, for example, you still need, you know, millions of American chestnut trees to have them come back and play the ecological role that they played. So, interesting idea. I'd love to see where it goes. Is it going to change the trajectory of ecosystems? I'm way more skeptical about that, simply because you need all these other pieces as well.
Yeah. How did you get so passionate about conservation? I read you were born in Sri Lanka, but you grew up in Africa. Did that have a profound effect on
you? Know, it's hard to know because it's not like I had a twin that had a different experience and I can compare the two. It's very difficult to know where passions come from. My sister had the exact same upbringing as me. And, you know, the only way I can get her to visit Montana is by telling her there's four seasons there. And she thinks it's the resort, not the fact that we actually have four seasons. So she's, you know, the exact opposite of me in every way. So I don't know where this comes from. I actually think that all kids have this fascination with things that move. It probably stems right back to sort of evolutionary history of humans and just being aware of our surroundings and aware of danger. For me, I was lucky enough that it never got beaten out of me as I grew up as a child. My parents allowed me to have these sort of passions and things, and I collected animals and I would bring them home And we had always had animals living around us or living with us when we were in Africa. But they always thought it was a hobby, you know, that being good Asian parents, you know, for them it was doctor, engineer, lawyer, you know, accountant. You know, these were the accepted professions.
Yeah, I read in an interview that your family really wanted you to become a doctor and that your grandmother, after you received a PhD in biology, would introduce you as a doctor, but not the kind who helps people.
Yeah, not the kind who saves people. She was quite explicit about that. I don't know why she had to add that. And, you know, interestingly, that made me think a little bit because, you know, is that what really conservation is? Are we really not saving people? It turns out that I actually think we are. I genuinely believe that conservation actually saves people. If you save nature, you live better. And so maybe I am the kind of doctor that does something to help people along the way.
Yeah. And so it does sound like growing up around animals, growing up in Africa, did have some kind of influence, but it's just hard to say exactly what.
It is hard to say exactly what. I think it's probably because parents were allowed me to explore. And that's probably the best thing you could do as a parent to a kid when they're fascinated with things that move, allow them to explore.
Yeah. And, you know, how did you realize then? Well, one of the things that I read that was also interesting was your work at UCSC, at UC Santa Cruz, that you actually created a wildlife corridor. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, so when I was at Santa Cruz, you know, this was the heyday of conservation biology. I worked with a professor named Michael Soule, who's often, you know, regarded as the father of conservation biology. He sort of coined the word conservation biology. He helped establish the journal for conservation biology. So it was a pretty incredible time, and all these new tools and techniques were coming out. And one of the things that I worked on was how you would design a landscape to be permeable to animals when everything around them was built up. And we actually got to put some of this into practice on a project I worked on for the Nature Conservancy in Southern California, where we helped create a wildlife corridor that would connect up a isolated preserve to the Los Padres National Forest and allow things like mountain lions and bobcats and lots of other animals, too, to slip through a landscape that was now human-dominated.
And I'm reading that this has really been a model.
It has. I mean, look, there's no way I'm going to take credit for wildlife corridors. Loads and loads of people work on them. But I really did have a hand in helping to design wildlife corridors, particularly in California, and then see them come to life right in front of me. That was exciting.
We'll continue our conversation with conservation scientist M. Sonjin, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild, after a short break. The series takes a fresh look at humankind's relationship to the planet's wildest places, and it will premiere February 4th on PBS. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. Do stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. My guest is conservation scientist M. Sonjin, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild. It's produced by National Geographic Television in association with Passion Planet and premieres February 4th on PBS. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to Kelly in San Francisco. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. So my question is for Professor Sonjin. I'm really interested in this issue of conservation ecology as well, but just in the conversation of sort of the climate is changing and that is having an impact on our oceans and our land systems, all of our terrestrial ecosystems, I'm wondering if it really even makes sense anymore to be talking about truly conservation ecology, or if the fact that the ecosystems today may not be the ecosystems that are supported by the climate of tomorrow means that we need to be shifting the way that we think about conservation to something more like adaptation ecology.
Thanks, Kelly.
That's a fantastic question. Kelly, I think you're right. I mean, in some ways, you're right. You know, we are living, it's no point putting your head in the sand and pretending it isn't there. We are in the Anthropocene. We are in a human-dominated world for the most part. And so you do have to think about the future and have to think about, you know, how are people going to live, but how are they sharing the planet with nature and what's the relationship between them? And adaptation becomes a very, very large part of the picture. But, you know, interesting thing is, you know, there are even though climate change is this giant overriding factor that's happening out there, you know, the impact of climate change is still being felt in different at different rates in different ways locally. So you still have to deal with habitat loss or a river drying up or an invasive species moving into some new place. So, you know, you still have those challenges, and those aren't going away. If anything, you know, they're sort of rapidly expanding. So I think, you know, there are places that are important to be conserved, but there's also a lot of landscape out there that is experiencing some change, and understanding that change is as important as just trying to prevent it.
Kelly, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Sean in Kensington. Hi, Sean.
Hello. Thanks for your lively exchange. I've been noticing an interesting dynamic in your conversation, at least my perception, in which there is a kind of aversion to allowing us to receive the full brunt of unsettling research findings. They somehow need to be given a hopeful spin. I noticed this in this morning's lead article in the New York Times Online, which is Ocean Life Faces Mass Extinction. The findings published in Nature are, in fact, quite dire. The article starts out with how this is a wake-up call and it's a very hopeful thing and nature is resilient and so on. The same for findings about methane releases and so on. I feel like I want to know what's actually happening. I don't really need to be placated by the hopeful spin. That's just a reflection for you to think about.
Sean, thanks. Do you want to respond to that?
It's a good point. I mean, look, no pessimist ever changed the world. So, you know, look, I don't watch a lot of environmental documentaries. I can't. I get too depressed. I turn them off. And so what's the point of me making a film, putting all this effort, 5 years and time and money in it, if no one's going to watch it, except for a small number of enlightened or already converted folks, perhaps like yourself? I need to be able to talk to people who aren't like myself. I need to talk to people who don't think in this way, and somehow capture their imagination so that they will sit and watch and get that message in a pretty subtle way. So there's always this balance. How much do I want to just shock and show you the planet as it is? But also I want to give you a way out. I can't just put you in a box and seal the box up. You know, it just isn't going to be a very useful exercise. And I can't help it. I am actually a bit of an optimist just by nature. I do think that human ingenuity is pretty profound. And I think that, you know, collectively we can get out of a lot of messes. So I do want to show you the truth, the unvarnished truth, but I don't want to leave you there. I want to be able to take you a little bit further. And listen, guess what? I still have fun with it too, right? I mean, it's not... I just was walking down in the bay yesterday, right? So I'm walking right along the water, and out there I'm actually watching a herd of sea lions chasing a school of fish. I can see the whole thing happening in front of me. Pelicans are diving. There's probably sharks circling underneath it. It's an amazing natural history spectacle. Now, I could have gone and filmed that and just showed you that, and you would have been amazed by it. But what makes it even more amazing to me is the fact that there's the Golden Gate Bridge on the left. There's Alcatraz out there. That it is happening within this bay. That, to me, is truly fantastic. And that's, to me, what I look for and what I want to live for.
Sean, thanks for the call. That's it. A listener writes, after hearing the Sami reindeer clip, I'd like to say that I'm disappointed that the show takes such a hokey approach. It seems that your guest is more focused on shocking viewers than educating them. It presents itself more like reality television than an educational documentary on an important topic. Please stop solving for the lowest common denominator and set higher expectations for your viewers. This is PBS, not Animal Planet. Before you answer, I just wanted to say that it was actually our forum's decision to play that clip just as a little teaser similar to what PBS put out as a teaser clip. So it doesn't represent the rest of the show, as the RLC clip pointed out. But do you want to just respond to this
Sure.
idea that
you know,
could be hokey?
I didn't try to do that because it was hokey. I wanted to look at what the Sami were doing with reindeer because they were the first. A lot of people think reindeer were the first animals that were domesticated. And it's interesting that the Sami used this method as a way in which they can control their herds. What's even more interesting is that the Sami in Europe, in Norway, were not allowed to do this, although the Russian Sami were, because of EU rules, because of sort of European rules about, you know, animal welfare. And only recently have the Sami gained their right to do this method again. But only the point where the guy actually who does the castration has to be a vet. So he's a Sami vet using sort of this traditional method to do it. The Sami also tell you when you're up there that these castrated males grow big. They have very large antlers. They don't spend all their energy fighting. And they think that as climate change creates a hard coat of ice, which they're experiencing more and more, it is these, as they call it, the gentlemen of the tundra, these castrated reindeer that have the power to punch through the ice and open it up for other reindeer to go in and eat lichen. You know, there are moments in the show when I'm surrounded by 14 panda bears. I can't help that. I went to the panda center. That's what they showed me. We didn't go out to try to find moments that would shock you. We went out to find the most amazing, compelling stories that showed that humans are still related and still connected to nature. Sometimes along the way, what you found was truly breathtaking. Sometimes they shocked, and so we show you that.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Dylan in Sacramento. Hi, Dylan.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick side note. I grew up in Montana, and I'm a UM graduate, so I love Missoula. My question for you is, over your travels, what have you seen as far as people trying to live in a more harmonic way with their environment? Meaning, one of the subjects that I've become really interested in lately is the theory of permaculture and how that can help to, one, improve your environment and, two, provide for your needs as well. But what have you seen along your travels as far as people implementing certain processes in order to live in a more harmonic way with their environment?
Right. Fantastic question. I love Montana as well. Two quick examples I'll give you. So we go into the Amazon and we look at how traditionally the Amazon probably supported very large human communities and how their technique or technology of really putting back organic material into the soil really allowed them to maintain the population densities in the past that it doesn't today. So really looking at a traditional technique of living, I don't want to use the word harmonious, but living in a way that accounted for the needs of nature. The other example is right there in Montana. So we spend a lot of time in the Centennial Valley, where cowboys are pretending to be wolves and their cattle are pretending to be bison. I mean, this is sort of their words. They're herding their cows in a particular way to mimic what the great herds must have once looked like on the plains. The cowboys playing the role of the wolves, the cattle playing the role of the bison, as a way of restoring grassland diversity. And it was a really amazing story that was happening really in my backyard.
Dylan, thanks for the call. We're talking with conservation scientist M. Sanjan, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild. The series premieres Wednesday, February 4th on PBS. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You said early on in the show that doing this series changed you and changed your understanding of certain relationships. I was wondering what you meant by that. What were some of the most sort of inspiring interactions with the natural world that you had while you were doing this?
Every story that we ended up investigating was amazing. And the people who were involved in it were like truly heroes of mine. It was interesting because at the end of this show, I felt less alone. I felt like there were others who were thinking as hard as I was and coming up with amazing results. And I didn't feel alone anymore. You know, most of these documentaries that I've done in the past have always left me a little bit more depressed at the end than at the beginning.
Really?
Because you go out to see something and then you see it and it disturbs you. This one was different. You know, we just met these amazing mavericks, these mavens, these druids who were able to come up with incredible ways of viewing nature and finding ways to incorporate wild nature into their lives and vice versa. So I was left more hopeful than when I started. When you see what they're doing in China, a place where loads of bad news environmental stories are coming from, but in this notion of getting pandas that are born in captivity, creating habitat for them and getting them out in the wild. Yeah, it's one little blip, but it's a pretty extraordinary blip. Or when you see what's happening with New York Harbor and the restoration of that, or the way in which the Maasai can live with lions if they incorporate a little bit of technology. To me, that was a bit hopeful. I found that pretty inspiring.
Was that in part because the emphasis of the show was to talk about humankind's interaction, as you said in some of the promotional trailers, like turning the camera on the humans or looking at the humans, that you then had a lot more interaction with people like yourself who were passionate about conservation?
Yeah, you know, so that's a very good point. So when you go out to typically make like a blue chip natural history documentary, what you do is you go find this amazing wildlife spectacle. Then you spend all your time trying to frame out the power lines and the people and the cattle herd in the background and the villages and all of that. And you spend this exhaustive amount of time trying to get further and further into, quote unquote, a pristine bit of landscape. And it becomes exhaustive. And by the end of it, you're sort of so frazzled because you realize that human influences have gone into every part of that vision that you had. We never set out to frame humans out. And when you did that, then you all of a sudden could actually see the entire bay, and you could see the Golden Gate Bridge, and you could see the predator-prey relationship happening within feet of, you know, a massive city on the West Coast. It all of a sudden, it's funny, you know, how you frame something completely changes the way in which you end up thinking about it.
Sanjan, one of the things I noticed that often environmental groups will target particular entities that are being destructive or that are being hard on the environment. And your series doesn't do that. Was that a conscious decision?
Well, you know, not really. I mean, look, we definitely point the finger at cotton as the primary demise
right,
of
the
RLC. We definitely spend time looking at the lettuce growing industry. Look, if you eat lettuce in the winter in North America, you're basically eating the Colorado River. And it's a choice that you probably didn't even know that you were making. So we don't target... We definitely talk about what choices we're making. When we go to the Amazon, we go to this place called the Intangible Zone where the Warani live in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I'm passing massive oil rigs, you know, flaring off gas right by me. And we absolutely talk about that because the Ecuadorian government put a price on it and said, look, if you want to save this forest, you know, we'll cough up some money. And we won't drill there. And if you don't, guess what? We got to develop. So we're going to go and drill. You see that in the show. So I do. I actually do that to some extent.
We're talking with Sanjan, host of the new PBS series Earth, a New Wild, that will premiere Wednesday, February 4th on PBS. Let's go to some of your calls. Let's go to Elliot in Palo Alto.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Professor Sanjan. I'm really excited to see the show, and it's great to hear all about it last night at the California Academy. My question kind of goes back to your experience working under Michael Soule and something of a non-debate, in my view, between Soule and Peter Kariva on the role of people in nature and whether or not conservation has a role in terms of protecting nature from people. And I wanted you to kind of speak further to this debate, and if it is a debate at all, your thoughts. I'm just curious.
It's an interesting intellectual debate. I actually don't spend a lot of time worrying about it. You know, there is so much happening that we need to work on right now. For me, to sort of focus on this becomes a huge, huge distraction. We are part of nature. We live on a very human-dominated planet. I would absolutely love it if a lot of people thought the way I do and enjoy going for a walk in the woods in Montana where there's something big enough that can come out and potentially kill me. That kind of makes me excited. But guess what? You know, that's not a great tagline for most of the planet. So love alone is not going to be enough. I have to give people a reason why saving nature is in their self-interest. That's the only way I know how to scale the message. So let me, you know, I want both. I actually kind of want both.
Elliot, thanks. Let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Luke in Berkeley. Hi, Luke.
Hi. I'm a restoration ecologist. I'm a rangeland ecologist out of Berkeley. And I was noting your comments earlier about the cowboys acting as wolves and livestock restoring native grasslands in Montana. And it's a compelling story, I find, for many people, this idea of livestock mimicking natural herds and then that restoring native grasslands. I like the idea, but at least in California, where I'm more familiar with the system, the grazing, I'm not saying is a bad thing, but it also doesn't tend to restore native grasslands. And I just thought I'd point that out, and I'd be curious to hear your take on your experience out in Montana and whether that's actually happening or are we sort of sugarcoating things just because it's a compelling story?
Luke, thanks.
That's a great question. You look, you know, for a long time, and probably rightly so, cows were sort of the enemy of environmental groups. And I don't particularly like cows. But if you go and spend time in the Serengeti or in the Masai Mara and you see how, you know, very traditional communities are herding cattle and you see wildlife and the interactions of wildlife around it, it's kind of an amazing thing to see. And that's been pretty influential in my life because it certainly wasn't always that way. You know, it's only in the last 3,000 or 4,000 years that the grasslands of East Africa have become as extensive as they have, probably because of cattle ranching by the oldest cowboys on the planet, the Maasai. In fact, in our series, there's one amazing sequence where we actually show lions hunting and killing a cow. I mean, you hear about depredation all the time, but this is the first time I'd ever seen it sort of on screen. You know, I spent time with a guy named Alan Savory, who's a bit controversial. He has a pretty famous TED Talk out there. But I go and see his ranch in Zimbabwe. And what he's done with his own land in Zimbabwe was pretty remarkable. There are cowboys, there are ranchers in the West, particularly in sort of the Intermountain West, the arid parts of North America, who are using Savory's methods or something similar to that as a way of either minimizing impact on the land or restoring the grasslands. Will it work everywhere? Even Savory admits it won't. If you're clearing the Amazon rainforest to grow cows, no matter how you ranch, you know, ranch those cows, you're not going to get the rainforest back. So all I'm saying is that grasslands evolved with large numbers of hoofs and mouths that were eating that grass and moving that grass around in a certain way. And it is probably right to think that you could mimic some part of that. Is it perfect? No. Is it end of the world? No.
Luke, thanks for the call. A listener writes, several times Prof. Sanjan has mentioned that protecting nature protects humans because humans depend on natural resources. But what about the flip side? How does protecting human life help wildlife? Consider that many people still live in poverty and depend on wood for fuel and lighting. How does human development coexist with nature protection?
That's a interesting question. It's a dichotomy, but it's a false dichotomy. Look, you know, I'm from Asia originally. You go to India and people will ask you, and we did in this show, for example, you know, how can you think about tigers in the forest if, you know, there are people quite literally in very dire straits on the borders of this forest? The truth is, if you clear-cut all those forests and you got rid of all the tigers in India, do you really think poverty will end? If that's the trade-off you're making, I think a lot of people would probably make that trade-off. I might be willing to make that trade-off. But the reality is all you would be left behind with is a country with poor people and now without tigers and forests. It turns out that for the poorest amongst us, nature provides the ultimate social security net. And once it's gone, then they really have nothing. So for me, allowing them to have those basic services like water, like food, like medicinal plants, really is very much reliant on nature. So I think it does work to some extent both ways. If you want people to to move up in the path towards development, however you want to think about it, you have to first start by making sure that nature is secure.
A listener writes, do you make a point of increased human population as being the major problem for conservation, tied to the idea of economic growth, which is tied to population growth? How do you treat, overpopulation in any way in this series?
We don't particularly deal with population growth in the series, although we don't shy away from the fact that, you know, the plains are gone because they're the breadbasket of the world. So we refer to the population, we refer to population growth as drivers. But this series isn't about how population growth is creating havoc for the planet.
Another listener writes, I'm a student in Palo Alto who is passionate about environmental issues, and I've really enjoyed listening to your idea about enlightened self-interest as a way to get people to engage with nature and understand its importance to us. I think it's wonderful that you've used your show as an outlet to try to send this message, and I wonder if you have any advice for those of us who would like to spread that message among our own communities. Are there particular stories or questions that you feel are useful in helping spread this perspective with friends and family who may not already share this view?
Okay, so this is I'll do a little bit of self-promotion on this. First of all, that phrase came from my boss, Peter Seligman, who's the CEO of Conservation International. But I love the phrase. Very recently, just a few months ago, we at Conservation International created a series of short films. You can see them if you go to natureisspeaking.org. And they're films that are narrated by superstars like Harrison Ford and Penelope Cruz and Julia Roberts and Edward Norton. And these folks take on the persona of the soil or of a river or of a rainforest or of the ocean. And they kind of make this message that says, look, you need me way more than I need you, and you're harming me at your peril. When you have Edward Norton saying, you know, as the soil saying, you treat me like dirt, you kind of get the message. Share that message with folks. So if you want to engage people in enlightened self-interest, share naturespeaking.org with others. Take a look at the films and pass them along.
And, you know, we actually have an example of one of these. It's of Harrison Ford being the ocean and sending this message about you need me more than I need you.
I am the ocean. I'm water. I'm most of this planet. I shaped it. Every stream, every cloud, and every raindrop, it all comes back to me. One way or another, every living thing here needs me. I'm the source. I'm what they crawled out of. Humans, they're no different. I don't owe them a thing. I give, they take. But I can always take back.
Right, so that's basically Harrison Ford lecturing you as the ocean. And if you meet Harrison, that's really his persona. You know, he really is passionate about this, and it comes through in that reading. When Kevin Spacey does it for Rainforest, it's a Francis Underwoodian, slightly smarmy Rainforest saying, I make air. You know, you do need air to live, don't you? Every video has its own personality, so you should sort of see them all. But I think they drive home this really important message, which is we need to save nature, if for no other reason, because it'll make our lives better.
And let's go to Jessica in Menlo Park. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment regarding many of the, several of the callers who have been commenting on how the information is being presented, and some, you know, feeling that it's not enough, we want it more raw, more honest, and others feeling, you know, oh, it's this or that is hokey, and I just wanted to say that I work as a public health educator on a different topic, on the issue of gender-based violence. However, I really appreciate your guest, how thoughtful he is about how he presents information. And one of those lessons that I've learned in my professional life is no matter how truthful or how important your message is, if your audience is not able to receive it, then it's useless. And so, you know, and social psychology also teaches us that people are not, people aren't just motivated by doing the right thing. People, you know, and they're not just motivated by having correct information. They're motivated by self-interest. And so, you know, I just wanted to kind of support your guest in what he was saying, that, you know, it doesn't matter how much I love bears or love the woods or whatever, you know, that's not going to motivate people. People are motivated by self-interest. And I just, as kind of an interdisciplinary, you know, approach or thought, just wanted to say, you know, that it's such a true message. And I think that's important for your listeners to hear that.
Jessica, that thanks. Thanks so much. Are there education materials associated with the show?
There are. So both PBS and the Nature Conservancy are building out a lot of this material that's sort of available. And, you know, Jessica, you're absolutely right. That's a great comment. So thank you. I obviously agree.
And Sanjan, one action you want people to take after watching your series?
Realize that, you know, saving nature is better for our lives, and support conservation organizations, either locally or globally. In my case, Conservation International, but the Nature Conservancy, National Geographic. And guess what? You know, KQED and PBS, they will never be able to make experimental programs like this, like really amazing shows, if they don't have support from you. So support them as well.
I'm Sanjan, host of the new PBS series Earth, A New Wild, premiering Wednesday, February 4th. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Mina.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.